you open your Bibles as we continue through the book of Numbers. We're in Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25. Lord, we do thank you that we can gather. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the Bible. As we commit this time to you, commit ourselves to you, we recognize that we really need to do that. Individually, all of us, and collectively as us, a congregation, as a fellowship of saints, we need to draw closer to you, and we know that. We need to make determined decisions to go after the things of you, to be involved in just our own personal discipleship, our own personal growth. We talked about this on Sunday morning with our sanctification. It's you. You are the God who sanctifies. Jesus, we're told in your word that you have become our righteousness and our sanctification. And all at the same time, you fill us with your Holy Spirit that we might walk with you, that we might do what you expect us to do. And this is part of that, us gathering together. Such an integral, important, critical component of our Christianity is that we would fellowship one with another. That koinonia, having all things in common, gathering around the Bible to study it, and Lord, for your word to study us. And so that's what we would ask for tonight. We commit it to you in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, chapter 25 of the book of Numbers starts this way. Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. Remember, this is coming off of the whole Balaam, Baalam, and Balak or Balak kind of three chapters and what exactly is going there and the whole talking donkey and all that incident. And then this happens here in chapter 25. And it says in verse 2, they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. Notice that. They invited them, just come on over. Just join us with this. What are you doing later today? Come, we're going to sacrifice to our gods. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Don't miss that in verse 2. It's not casual. They bowed down. There's some reverence implied in that. A giving oneself over is implied in that. Submission is implied in that. And so Israel, verse 3, was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord, the anger of Yahweh, was aroused against Israel. And so we talked about this a little bit last week, you know, exactly what happened, and the New Testament commentary that we noticed from 2 Peter as well as from Jude, and then I reminded you of the New Testament commentary in the book of Revelation from Jesus Christ, from Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14, that Balaam taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, and they ate food sacrificed to idols and then to commit sexual immorality. And after service, actually, last week, Ken and I were talking about this section, and Ken reminded me, I'd completely either forgotten or didn't even realize it, that this is also mentioned later in the New Testament. As a matter of fact, it's mentioned right here in the book of Numbers, exactly what happened that got us to the beginning of these events in chapter 25. This is actually, if you want to flip over just a couple pages, chapter 31 of Numbers and verse 16, and we'll get to this, the details here for this chapter. Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. So the counsel of Balaam. And so Jesus, again, provided the instruction with that as to what happened, but based on the own book, this book here in Numbers, we see this. And it seems, therefore, based on the events of chapters 22, 23, and 24, then obviously with 2 Peter, Jude, and Revelation chapter 2, that Balak must have paid Balaam to instruct him how to defeat Israel. Well, just curse the people. I can't. I can only do what the Lord sets before me to do. Well, can you try again? Sure. But I'll only speak what the Lord commands me to speak. And so then it would seem that along the way, it's like, hey man, listen, if you pay me this, I'll give you the goods as how you're going to get these people to kind of bow out of following the Lord. So he provided this counsel, and the instruction how to defeat Israel was that, did we talk about it? Yeah, we talked about it a little bit last week, that if they could get them to defeat themselves, perfect. And the means, twofold, and it's exactly what's happening right here in chapter 25, idolatry and immorality. Again, there in verse 2, they bowed down to their gods. And then please do not miss the strong wording here in verse 3. They were joined to Baal of Peor. Joined to Baal. I mean, this is kind of this intimate picture. Like, think marriage. A man shall be joined to his wife. And what do you find so often in the Old Testament? The nation of Israel was often accused, and rightly so, accused of spiritual adultery against the Lord. They had denied their faithfulness to Him and gone after, bowed down to join themselves to something else. This is strong wording, and it's important for us as we recognize the applicable value of what this is. This is how sin works. Oh, we could go on and on, spend a lot of time just on verses 2 and 3. They bowed down, they were joined to Baal. Think all the way back to the book of Genesis. Bless you. With Cain and Abel. Oh, sin is crouching at your door, and its desire is to rule over you, but you are to rule over it. It wants to cling to you. Wants to cling to you. Like, think of a man. I was thinking about this in the animal kingdom. Like, think of an octopus or a squid trying to pry open a clam. Just clinging to that thing and just wants to break it open and get in and wreak havoc in whatever way it can. This is what sin wants. That's not a big deal. No, it's actually a big deal. So then, verse 4, the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun. This is public. That the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor. And again, a great picture of what was happening with sin, but now a great picture of how to deal with sin. What would the New Testament tell us? We are to crucify the flesh. Literally, it can be translated, mortify the flesh. The happy terminology in the New Testament would be, make a corpse out of it. Ugh. Someone said it this way, some old preacher, I don't remember who. You don't outgrow sin. It must be put to death. Mortify the flesh. There's no room for this with the people of God. So the other thing with what's happening here is they're doing this. This is the people indicating now that they are with the Lord. There were certain that had gone after Baal, and there's others that had not. And so it's them saying, it's them indicating that they're with the Lord, them indicating that they're on His side, they're for Him, they are not for Baal. And essentially, again, what's happening here in verses 4 and 5, it's indicative of people taking sin as seriously as God takes sin. And we might ask, well, how seriously does He take it? Apparently, if our redemption, the only means of it, the only way that sin could be dealt with in our lives would be the death of His Son, oh, He takes it seriously. And indeed, verse 6, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the congregation and took a javelin in his hand. Like, where's this going? And verse 8, he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through the man of Israel. Aren't you glad you come on Wednesdays, right? The man of Israel and the woman through her body. And so the plague was stopped among the children of Israel. Apparently, he was taking it seriously. God's opinion? Well, verse 9 first. And those who died in the plague were 24,000. And this is God's opinion, verse 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel. Why? Because he was zealous, notice this, with my zeal among them. The same zeal that the Lord had, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace. To that guy? To that guy. And it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. Now the name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of his father's house among the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Kotzbi, the daughter of Tzur, and he was head of the people of a father's house in Midian. By the way, side note to this whole episode, besides being zealous with a godly zeal, it's absolutely worth the mention of what's noted here for us, especially in verses 14 and 15. These two folks were from the families of leaders. There's no get out of jail cards to be played there. Well, that person's super important no matter. No favoritism in these types of things. Interesting. And then verse 16, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, harass the Midianites and attack them. It's time to go on the offensive side of the ball. For they attacked you with their schemes by which they seduced you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Kotzbi, the daughter of a leader of Midian, their sister who was killed in the day of the plague because of Peor. To war. Fascinating. This is a side study unto itself, but how many times in just even the Old Testament, even just up to this point, where there's times where it's let it go, and other times, no, we're not letting it go. We're going right now. Like, I think about Abraham, you know, when he had Lot and their land wasn't quite big enough for all the herds and everything they had. And it was, Lot, you know what? Man, you pick. Whichever way you go, I'll go. If you go to the east, I'll go to the west. You go north, I'll go to the south. So you pick. Abraham didn't force the issue. But if you remember some chapters later, when Lot was captured by, was it the five kings, like Chedorlaomer, the cheese guy, and all these different kings and whatnot, and he was abducted and carted off, well, what did Abraham do? He took his, was it like 318, something like that, men who were trained for war, and like, right now we're going to go attack, we're going to go rescue Lot. There's times for battle and times where it's just let it go. This was a time for battle. Chapter 26. And it came to pass after the plague that the Lord spoke to Moses and Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest. Remember, Aaron is now, he's dead and gone. And what we get here in chapter 26, and go ahead and peruse it, 65 verses, so buckle up for safety, make shoulder strap and everything here. We got a little bit of work to do. But this would be the second census. Second census. It says in verse 2, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and above by their father's houses, all who were able to go to war in Israel. So those who were of the age to be soldiers. So Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, across from Jericho. This is putting some definition in the geography here. Across from Jericho. Take a census, verse 4, of the people from 20 years old and above, just as the Lord commanded Moses and the children of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt. Of course, in chapter 1 is where we find this first census that's initiated. And in verse 2 of chapter 1, they were to take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel. And so chapters 1 and 2 give us that information about the numbers, the census, the population of these individual tribes. And then, actually, if you would flip back a few chapters, then in chapter 14, we get some details as to why there's now this second census. Like, why are we doing this? We already had that number. Do we really need to go through this? Oh, yes, actually, we do, because of a certain event. Kind of smack dab in the middle of the book of Numbers. Pick it up in verse 26 of Numbers chapter 14. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complains against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses, again, happy Wednesday, the carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered, that first census, according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. So this is now the second census here in chapter 26. It's, well, quite a bit has happened in the last, you know, however many chapters, and essentially 38 years since they took that first census. And so this was that generation, and they're going to die in the wilderness. And this next generation, the second census, are those who will enter into the promised land. It's kind of a fascinating side study in itself. So here we go. Verse 5 says, Reuben was the firstborn of Israel. The children of Reuben were of Hanok, the family of the Hanokites, of Palu, the family of the Paluites, of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Carmi, the family of the Carmites. These are the families of the Reubenites. Those who were numbered of them were 43,730. And the son of Palu was Eliab, and the sons of Eliab were Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram. And these were Dathan and Abiram, representatives of the congregation, who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah when they contended against the Lord. You remember those guys is kind of what's being said here. And the earth, verse 10, opened its mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when the company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a sign. Nevertheless, the children of Korah did not die. Like, not all of them were killed. Just interesting there, that little side note. Not all of them, not all the children of Korah died. You find the name Korah again in the Old Testament. You're Wednesday night people. Where do you find that name again? Psalms. They were like part of the song team of Israel. Like, they figured it out at some point, right? It's pretty great. So here you go. Just with this being a census, I'm going to throw numbers at you. And if you want to turn back to chapter 1 and 2, you're welcome. But here in verse 7 of chapter 26 concerning Reuben, and throw something at me if I'm throwing the numbers out wrong, 43,730. In chapter 1, they started with 46,500. So in these 38 years, they actually lost 2,770 of their men who would be trained or age appropriate, if you will, for war. So I'm going to spend a couple minutes discussing this and then kind of work through the rest of these fairly quickly. But apparently for the tribe of Reuben, this time of wandering had been, in a word, costly. Let me say that again. This time of wandering had been costly. Since repetition reinforces, a time of wandering in our Christian lives often proves to be costly. But the Lord's still the Lord, and the Lord's still so good. As I was thinking about this, like, man, that's rough for the Reubenites, and we're going to see that kind of thing for essentially half of the tribes. The other half, they improved in terms of their numbers and their population. So the Lord's good no matter what, obviously. And I was thinking about this and thinking about just what the Lord does in our lives. And I was thinking about John chapter 15. Oh, you know John chapter 15, where Jesus says, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do no thing, right? Nothing. And of course, included in the context of John chapter 15, there is abiding in him, obviously, and then also pruning, the cutting back of certain things. And why do you prune? We're just talking about, like, house plants and whatnot, you know, before service started. And, like, some people are just terrible, and, like, basically, if a plant arrives in your house, it's like a death sentence for that poor plant, you know. But some people are really good at this kind of thing, and whatever. My daughters are really good at promoting further growth in houseplants. But pruning is part of that process. I remember years ago when we lived in Hungary, one of the houses where we lived on campus, there was like this kind of row of rose bushes. And I think it was like Robert and Diane came to visit and some friends of ours from New Jersey, and like, man, these rose bushes need to be pruned. And he just got out like the hedge clippers or whatever and just started lopping them off. And I'm thinking, thanks, Robert. Like, thus endeth the life of our rose garden, you know, and like just felt like he chopped it back to the stump. But if you know anything about pruning, you know that the next season, man, they were the healthiest roses we had ever seen. Like, I'm thinking, our friend is killing our roses, but just the opposite. And sometimes that's necessary in our lives. There's that pruning, that cutting back, that season to promote growth, to promote healthy, strong, focused growth. If you don't prune, the branches just kind of grow in all directions, and it takes all this energy to get just that one little rosebud to that long branch as opposed to focused growth. And again, it's kind of a side note, and that's why I'm spending a little bit extra time on, like, really? Am I spending extra time on the 47,000 whatever it is? Like, yeah, a little bit. Because in like manner, kind of in keeping with this concept of cutting back, cutting off, we have in Romans chapter 2 the circumcision of the heart that involves the cutting away of that which is not needful, the further removal of the flesh life. And I keep going back to this, maybe I just so enjoyed the book of Colossians, but in chapter 3, it's the put off this stuff so that we might put on this. And what do we find in the Gospel of John? You find this from John the Baptist. I must decrease, he must increase. Like, this is true for you just as true as it's true for me. Excuse me. What's true is, in my own life, and probably for us as a congregation, actually, the less of Jeremy Foster there is, the better. The less of me there is and more opportunity for Jesus there is, the better. Cutting away that which is unnecessary. So again, we're going to see both happen in this long chapter. But apparently what was good for Reuben was a smaller fighting force, not just for the numeric value, but perhaps a fighting force that was more, again, focused. Because that previous generation, yeah, we can't go into the land. There's giants, there's cities, the people are numerous. We'll never be able to do this. As opposed to a smaller group that said, yeah, we can. We need to go right now. And that focus would be to their advantage. It's, you know, keep going with examples, but think about Gideon's army in the book of Judges. 300? Perfect. That's the number we need. I don't want to get carried away with this, but it's an interesting reality right now on our planet as we're watching this smaller Ukrainian army repelling the supposed glorious, mighty Russian army that's making them look like an abject joke. And this focused, this country that's seen a few decades of freedom, democracy, saying, no, we'll fight to the death for this. Interesting. This massive army, almost no match for them. So Reuben, again, 2,770 fewer soldiers, and apparently this was perfect. And then, again, these notes related to that, verses 8 through 11, and what exactly happened with these other couple of guys. And then we move on to Simeon. Verse 12, the sons of Simeon, according to their families, were of Nemuel, the families of the Nemuelites of Yamin, the families of the Yamanites of Yachin, the family of the Yachinites of Zerah. Verse 13, the family of the Zacharites of Shaul, the family of the Shaulites. And these are the families of the Simeonites, 22,200. Chapter 1, check this out, 22,200, chapter 1, this is verse 23, 59,300. That's 37,100 fewer men. One comment, I was like already doing the math and I found a commentator that supplied the percentages. Like, oh, thank you so much, sir. And he said this is 63% smaller of a group, all in the span of 38 years. Of Gad, verse 15, the sons of Gad, according to their families, were Tzaphon of the family of the same name, Haggai, the family of the same name, Shuni, same name, of Otzni, verse 16, same name, Eri, the family of the Eriites, of Arod, the family of the Arodites, Areli, the family of the Areliites, verse 18, these are the families of the sons of Gad, or actually it's probably better pronounced God, according to those who were numbered of them, 40,500. Chapter 1, 45,650. So these guys were diminished by 5,150. Of Judah, the sons of Judah were Ur and Onan. And you remember Ur and Onan, they died in the land of Canaan. You can go back to that story if you'd like. And the sons of Judah, according to their families, were of Shelah, of that family, of Perez, of Zerah, and the sons of Perez, of Hethron, verse 21, the family of the Hethronites, of Hamul, etc. Verse 22, these are the families of Judah, according to those who were numbered of them, 76,500. Chapter 1, verse 27, 74,600. I think I have that right. It's a difference of 1,900 soldiers. You get in verse 23 to 25, Issachar, and you can read the names there, Tola, Pua, Yashub, verse 24, Shimron. These are the families of Issachar, and they were 64,300. Chapter 1 and verse 29, 54,400. So that's actually an 18% increase. It's plus 9,000 men. So good news for them, right? Zebulun is verses 26 and 27, according to the families of Sered, Elon, Yahil, or Yahlil, excuse me, or probably Yahlael of the Yahalelites. And these are the families of the Zebulunites, according to those who were numbered of them, 60,500. Chapter 1, there were 57,400. And you can look these up if you'd like on your own, and that's a plus 3,100 increase. Then you get kind of an interesting passage here on the sons of Joseph, starting in verse 28, according to their families, by Manasseh and Ephraim. They were, verse 29, the sons of Manasseh, of Machir, of Gilead, of verse 30, the sons of Gilead, of Jetzer, of Helek, and of verse 31, Asriel, and of Shechem, the family of the Shechemites, verse 32, Shemida, the family of the Shemidites, of Hefer, the family of those guys, and verse 33, Zelophehad, the son of Hefer had no sons but daughters, and the names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahlal, Noah, Hoglah. Who names their daughter Hoglah? I don't know, but this is probably a beautiful Hebrew name, right? Milcah and Tirzah. So the families, these are the families of Manasseh, excuse me, of those who were numbered of them, 52,700. Well, in chapter 1, they started with 32,200, so that's a 20,500 person or men for war, 64% increase, fairly massive. Then you get verse 35, again, the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, and it starts here, notice this, with Manasseh, and then it gets to verse 35 in the sons of Ephraim, of this person, Shuthelah, of those guys, Becher, the family of those guys, Tachan, and the sons of Shuthelah, of Aran, of the Aranites, verse 36, and then verse 37, these are the families of the sons of Ephraim, according to those who were numbered of them, 32,500, and these are the sons of Joseph according to their family. So Ephraim, 32,500. In chapter 1, it was 40,500, so 8,000 man decrease. It's worth the mention. I hinted at it here just a moment ago. Again, the sons of Joseph, according to their families, Manasseh and Ephraim. Well, how do you normally think of them? You think of them as Manasseh and Ephraim, or Ephraim and Manasseh. They're listed in that order here. In chapter 1, with the first census, it's Ephraim's listed first, and Manasseh is listed second. At the second census here in chapter 26, and do what you want with this, but Manasseh, there's a plus 64% increase, where Ephraim, that family, was a minus 20% growth rate, a decrease, which is pretty drastic, and so just kind of a wide swing between the two. So I'm not saying that's why they were listed in a different order, but based on what's happening here in chapter 26, it goes to the order of Manasseh and Ephraim, as opposed to the typical Ephraim and Manasseh. Interesting stuff. Again, kind of do what you want with that. In verse 38, we have the sons of Benjamin, or Benjamin. They were of the family of Bela, Ashbel, Ahiram, and verse 39, Shufam, Hufam, great names. We had twin boys, Shufam and Hufam would have been perfect for that. Verse 40, the sons of Bela and Ard and Naaman of Ard, the family of the Ardites, Naaman, etc. These are the sons of Benjamin, verse 41, according to their families, and those who were numbered of them were 45,600. In chapter 1, it was 35,400. So in 38 years, that's a 10,200 soldier increase. And then you have the tribe of Dan in verses 42 and 43. The sons of Dan, according to their families, of Shuham, the Shuhamites, etc. Verse 43, all the families of the Shuhamites, according to those who were numbered of them, were 64,400. That's a pretty massive group. And that's actually up 1,700 people from the first census, which was 62,700. And so again, some of these tribes clearly multiplied. Others sustained loss, and some sustained great loss. And I'm going to come back to this concept, because is it actually loss? The number's smaller, but does that mean loss? That's kind of a trick question. So again, there's like this idea of pruning, get rid of that which is not needful, not helpful. And for this army, I mean, do you remember, and I mentioned this a moment ago, with Gideon and his army, man, that was a pretty good-sized army. It wasn't anything compared to the enemy, if you remember, and we'll get to that in a year or whatever when we get the judges, but the first kind of drop of, let's say, attendance for his army, hey, if you're afraid, just go ahead and go home. Yeah, I'm afraid. Okay, see you later. Like, really? Why? You know what fear is? Super contagious. And if you're a person of faith, and you're trying to live for Jesus, but the person next, man, I don't know, I'm pretty scared of this. Like, that's not exactly invigorating for one's faith. So you guys are scared? And imagine that, like, literally in the trenches. I'm really scared. Come on, man, we got to go. No, I don't think that we can, plural, we can, I don't think we can. That doesn't help morale. So you guys just go ahead and go home. So sometimes there's that purging which encourages good growth. But there's clearly these other tribes that were just blessed numerically. At any rate, we get to verse 44, and Asher, sons of Asher according to their families, Yimnah, Yasui, Beriah, verse 45, of Heber, the Heberites, Machiel, and the name of the daughter of Asher was Sarah. And these are the families of the sons of Asher, according to those who were numbered of them, 53,400. Riveting stuff here, right? There's all these numbers. Chapter 1, it was 41,500. So this is a pretty good size increase, too. It's plus 11,900 more troops. Naphtali, verses 48 to 50, the sons of Naphtali, according to their families, Yatziel, Guni, Yetzer, Shiliem. Verse 50, the families of Naphtali, according to those who were numbered of them, were 45,400. In chapter 1, it was 53,400. That's an 8,000 person decrease. Again, why is this important? It's not a decrease in the sense that they lost 8,000 men. No, actually, what did they lose? The census at the beginning, the first census, they had 53,400, and guess how many of the 53,400 died? All of them, right? Thus the point of the second census, or they were nearly dead in their wandering, and that whole generation was going to die. So it's like, man, all those people, no, it's not just 8,000. They all died, and so it's just a smaller group that came from that original number. So that leaves us with verse 51. If I'm following my own notes here, these were those who were numbered of the children of Israel, 601,730. Chapter 1, verse 46, 603,550. which is a decrease, when all is said and done here, of 1,820 people. Like, that's it. Less than 2,000. Like, it seemed like, man, that one tribe lost so many. And that other tribe grew substantially. So nearly the same. And again, this is what's so fascinating about the whole conversation. At least it is to me. It's a chapter about a census. Oh, man, but there's something in here for us. No growth. In fact, it's a deficit in that regard. Yeah, what about the purging thing? Yes, and that's what the Lord is happy to do, but just kind of looking at it in this vantage point, 38 years of wandering, in 38 years you should see some growth, right? Wandering, again, is either purging and pruning, or it's just wasted time. And for that older generation at the first census, it was time spent traveling in circles. What's a great English expression we have for this? Spinning your wheels. How's your growth happening in your discipleship? I'm just kind of spinning my wheels, so then no growth. Not a lot, so then no growth. Not, you're spinning your wheels, wandering around in circles, no growth. Interesting. Like, you would expect after 38 years of anything, something would happen. I was talking to one of my band kids today, and just kind of messing around with the drums, and oh, Mr. Foster, oh, you're pretty good. Like, okay, well, thank you. You know, sort of. I said, I started playing in 1988. So if at this point in my life I'm really still very bad at this, I probably should have quit 25 years ago. You know, so thank you for the comment. And I hope after, you know, 38 years or whatever, like, you're, hopefully you've developed a little bit. But this entire generation, spinning their wheels. But this new generation, though slightly smaller, was bold enough to move, bold enough to move forward, bold enough to seek progress. Again, fascinating. In those 38 years, there should have been some growth. What's weird to me is almost like the psychological study of the nation of Israel. They grew far more substantially while they were slaves in Egypt. Isn't that weird? Like, well, they're slaves. It was just like this population explosion. And they're wandering, kind of nothing in particular. You can put that in your notes. By the way, kind of thinking about this in application, you might take some time and do a side study on these three chapters in the New Testament. Matthew chapter 9. Not the whole chapter necessarily, but chapter 9 of Matthew, chapter 2 of Mark, and chapter 5 of Luke. Matthew 9, Mark 2, Luke 5, and look for the passages in those chapters where Jesus talks about new and old wine and new and old wineskin. That old generation that was dominated by fear and faithlessness, they would hold back this new generation that needed to say, we've got to keep going forward. Yeah, but this is how we used to. It's time to move forward. They needed to be set to the side in their wandering. Verse 52 says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, to these the land shall be divided as an inheritance according to the number of names. To a large tribe you shall give a larger inheritance, and to a small tribe you shall give a smaller inheritance. Each shall be given its inheritance according to those who were numbered of them. But the land, verse 55, shall be divided by lot. They shall inherit according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. According to the lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller. Seems fair. The bigger tribe would get more land. Not only does it seem fair, it seems pretty practical. By the way, it's also not based on what? It's not based on birth order. Seniority. I've been here longer, so I definitely get... No, it's not based on that. But it's also, this is like a critical point here, it's also not based on the past. Okay, what does that mean? It's not based on what? The first census. It's on the basis of the second census. Well, when we left Egypt, we were rocking. We had the biggest tribe. Okay, I understand now that we're much smaller, but you know, eventually, so we should get a bigger... No. You're a smaller tribe now. Yeah, but when we left, you're... Yeah, but that's the past, but right now you're this. And actually, this tribe is greater, and so they get this. Well, that's not fair. Here's a good example. In chapter 1, Simeon had 5,000 more, I'll say troops, 5,000 more troops than did Issachar. 5,000 more, that seems pretty substantial. 38 years later, here in chapter 26, Issachar was 42,000 more than Simeon, nearly triple their tribal population. 38 years later. Yeah, but back then... Cool, back then we didn't have the land, we weren't in the land. If we were, then yes, you would have had that, but right now, you don't. It's just an interesting kind of thing how the Lord is practical with these things and bases it on what they're doing right now. And don't forget about the priests. Verse 57, these are those who are numbered of the Levites according to the families of Gershon, Kohath, Merari. These are the families, verse 58, of the Levites, the family of the Libnites, the family of the Hebronites, the family of the Mahalites, the family of the Mushites, the family of the Korites, and Kohath begot Amram. The name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, the daughter of Levi. These names sound familiar, I'm sure, who was born to Levi in Egypt, and to Amram she bore Aaron and Moses and their sister Miriam. So it's giving us the history here. To Aaron were born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord as they offered profane fire. Now those who were numbered of them were 23,000, every male from a month old and above, for they were not numbered among the other children of Israel because there was no inheritance given to them among the children of Israel. So there's actually a little bit of growth for the Levites from chapter 3, and of course, as it's stated here, they weren't counted with the nation's men of war. Verse 63 says, these are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the children of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. But among those, there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest when they numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord had said to them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. So there was not left a man of them except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. So actually quite relevant here as well. Though, as I mentioned, wandering doesn't bring growth. The numbers are just a bit not deceiving, but they need to have this further note. Once again, I kind of alluded to this a moment ago. The second census right here, the youth, those who would enter the land, that's who's numbered here. The first census, not included here. They're not in this second census in chapter 26. They were all either dead or about to die out in the wilderness. So they had children, and they bore fruit. But again, compared to the numeric growth in Egypt, it wasn't even comparable to almost any degree. That brings us to chapter 27. Everybody doing okay? Need to do a couple jumping jacks or something, kind of get the blood flowing? No? All right. Chapter 27. Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. And these were the names of his daughters. Here they are again. Mahlal, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. So these guys were mentioned in chapter 26, verse 33. And they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord in company with Korah. He wasn't one of those guys. He died, but he wasn't those. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. So their question, verse 4, why should the name of our father be removed or essentially purged from among the family, from among his family, because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. So inheritance, of course, in that culture, in so many ancient cultures and still a lot of cultures today, inheritances typically passed from fathers to sons. Women at marriage, this doesn't seem fair. Well, women, where it is fair, they received instead a dowry, probably from dad, but dad could also request that his future son-in-law would provide for her, so she's not destitute if something happened to him. So in that regard, that their needs would be met too. And so these young ladies lost their dad, and what's to be done? What are we supposed to do about this? That's a great question. Moses doesn't know, but he knows where to turn. Verse 5, so Moses brought their case before the Lord, wisdom. And the Lord spoke, verse 6, to Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. So the Lord's giving the practical advice here, what they're to do. And you shall speak, verse 8, to the children of Israel, saying, this is going to apply to everybody, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, he's just a, you know, single child, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers, to his uncles. And if his father had no brothers, you know, no other relatives in that regard, then you shall give his inheritance to the relative closest to him in his family, and he shall possess it, the land, and it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded Moses. Of course, this seems to be fair. This seems to be a practical thing to do. But in chapter 36, we won't talk about this tonight, but there'll be some issues related to this that will also need some answers. By the way, this is a super cool side note here. Really? Really is. It's subtle, but when you see it, it's this glorious thing. These are some fantastic women of faith. Why? Their dad died and they have no land. Like that's so much faith. No, what's amazing about these ladies here, where were they? On this side of Jordan, opposite Jericho, in the plains there of Moab. They were not yet in the promised land, but they spoke about their possession as though it were a certainty. When we get there, our dad would have this. What do we get? Because, what are they saying? Because we're going. We will arrive. We will make it. This is amazing. I love this kind of faith that speaks in terms of it's as good as done. It reminds me really of, was it the centurion whose servant was sick? And what did he say to Jesus? Only say the word and my servant shall be healed. And he was a man who understood authority. He had men under him and whatnot. And Jesus' response was pretty remarkable, where he said, I've not seen such great faith even in the land of Israel. Like, what's so impressive about that? Because this man, being a good soldier, understood, if I say something, I need you to do this, it was what? As good as done. There was no follow-up. Hey, private, did you do that? Totally forgot, sir. Okay, well, let's get it. You just do it. He understood authority. So what he said to Jesus was, I get authority. If you say the word, it's as good as done. I don't even need you to be there. Jesus is amazed by this. These ladies, it's that same kind of faith. Just tell us. What's the answer? Because we are going. They're speaking about this in future tense in the practical or in the present. It's amazing. Faith takes hold of that which God has declared as though it's as good as done. Amazing, actually. Verse 12 says, now the Lord said to Moses, go up into this Mount Abarim, and see the land of which I have given to the children of Israel. Wait, what's happening here? Moses gets to go up this mountain, and when you have, verse 13, seen it, you shall also be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was gathered. Why? For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, Moses, you rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Of course, Moses is not about to die here in this chapter. We'll read about that in Deuteronomy chapter 34. But here God is explaining to Moses what is to come. Got to go up to the mountain and look over and see the promised land. I'm reminded of Dr. King's words, which echoed these generations later, of course. April 3rd, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee. You guys are familiar with at least part of this, I'm sure. This is just a snippet of it. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. He's allowed me to go up to the mountain and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. This is a direct reference to this. Sounds familiar. And of course, you know, he was assassinated the next day. So Moses was allowed to go to the mountaintop. He'd be allowed to look over and see the promised land. He would not get there with the people of Israel. That's pertinent. He would not get to be there with them. And since that's the case, verse 15, then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh," spirits of all flesh, we're not just matter, we're not just beasts, spiritual beings, "the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd." What is he doing here? He's putting on a show of what true leadership looks like. Since I'm not going to be there, God, we need to have someone in place to lead. What did Moses know? He knew it wasn't about him. The Lord would appoint a leader, but it's not about the leader. Moses is essentially this. I just happen to be this leader currently, but if you're saying I'm not going to arrive there in the land, then we're going to need another leader, Lord. You're going to have to appoint someone else. Moses, as a great leader, his first interest, his first concern, the welfare of the people he's been charged to lead. And did you catch that little snippet there in verse 17? Sheep without a shepherd. Interesting that Jesus would quote Moses in Matthew chapter 9 concerning the weary and scattered multitudes. Sheep without a shepherd. And the Lord said to Moses, verse 18, "Take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight." Everyone needs to see this. "And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient." So the process of passing the proverbial baton, he's going to have some authority here as well. "He shall," verse 21, "stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim." And we talked about that back in Exodus, I think. "At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, and he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation." And so Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. He laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. So you now have, instead of Moses and Aaron, you have Joshua and Eleazar. So this is a new team, and don't miss what's happening. The public proclamation of this, the laying on of the hands. We've seen this all throughout these books here, the Pentateuch. What do you find? The laying on of the hands, in a word, is what? Identification. We're recognizing, we're identifying, this man is the man who is to lead. Identifying, recognizing them publicly, as it says here in the New King James, inaugurated. Some of your translations might say commissioned. Another good word, ordained. We're ordaining this man. We're recognizing this person right here. Like when we do those kinds of things here at the church, when like laying on the hands of certain people to lead certain capacities. Hey, everybody, check it out publicly. This is who the Lord has called to this specific ministry. This is exactly what's happening. And I'm sure there's this like part of Moses that's thinking, man, I'd love to get in the promised land, but the people, that was of utmost importance, but the people will be in excellent hands, of course, with Joshua. I'd love to get into chapter 28, but I'm looking at the clock. God bless you guys. Chapter 8, or 28. I also need the break, apparently, but chapter 28 next week. Have a great night. Thanks for coming. See you later.